Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Welcome back. Happy New Year, everyone. Carter, Happy New Year.
Thank you, buddy. 25 I know. 25 days later.
25 days later. I don't know. How long can you say Happy New Year without looking like an asshole?
I think you can say it through January.
Through January.
You have until the end of January to like present your New Year's wishes.
For the first time you see someone, right?
Yeah, but I don't think you can do it in like February.
No. If you do it in February, you have to say, I actually meant Chinese New Year.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then,
but that could be in January, depending.
You can save yourself.
This year, Chinese New Year is late.
Usually, there we go.
There you go. Anyhow.
Well, I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, here on Snacky Tunes. Greg is out in the Park City at movie premieres, walking red carpets.
Oh, really? I thought he was in London.
Or, and is it L.A.?
Oh, I don't know.
We're not sure.
Oh, it must be hard.
Must be hard. But we miss you, buddy. Stay safe on those slopes. That was just our wonderful band, Klaus with Chump. And they'll be playing later in the half of the show, sipping some beers, eating some pizza real soon. You might recognize that awesome bearded voice as our longtime co-host, fill-in Carter Adams. Cardam.
Hello, hello.
Good to see you. Great to see you last night.
It was, I barely remember seeing you. Actually, I remember seeing you. You got me in. That was wonderful. Thank you. And shout out to Bryn Mawr. He had his
record release.
It was great.
It was
so
great.
Good.
It was really great. Super
Speaking
packed.
Of Chinese New Year, it was in a dim sum place.
8080's Palace would be that the venue where when I try and tell my kids that I was cool, I was like, I used to go to raves with like Uncle Carter at this dim sum place. And they're like, no one cares, Dad.
Right.
No one cares.
Yeah, nobody cares.
Yeah, even my coworkers won't care on Monday. Anyway, I want to welcome to the show Scott and Mark of Sir Kensington's. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It was such a great... this is why I love New York. I ran into you at some... I didn't even remember where I ran into you.
It was at 88 Palace.
Oh, it was at 88 Palace.
It wasn't at Sundance?
It was at the Lucky Peach holiday party.
Right. Oh, that was a fun party. I got a little knockback on that one. Well, they had
so inebriated that you invited me on the show.
They literally had beers in the coat check line. Like, you didn't have to wait to get your coat off. You could just have a beer.
First that is a hosting. Good... Well, what type of sponsorship money do you have to pay to do that?
I don't know. How deep are Tiger Beer's pockets?
Probably not that deep.
Not that deep. Product. No, but you don't understand. We have a lot of free product we can give you. Oh, boy. Anyway, we want to thank you guys for coming on. Guys probably have the most gentleman of condiments in the world, the most fancy, the most prestige, if you will.
Is that just because they're called Sir?
Well, I mean, the logo and everything. Every time I eat your condiments, I feel like a little bit more regal.
Well, that's our goal, is to help you feel distinguished.
So for people who don't know what Sir Kensington's is, please take us through your magical world of condiments.
So Sir Kensington's is a line of classic American condiments that have been reimagined to be created with all natural ingredients and have more interesting textures, more interesting flavors that are kind of, have a closer relationship to what those condiments would have tasted like maybe 100 years ago or when they were first really invented or became part of the food world. And as you mentioned, it's all wrapped up in a distinguished package. And we sell in a number of stores across the United States, and we work with restaurants as well.
I want to touch on, I know the flavor, we're going to get to it, but the texture thing is really interesting because a lot of people don't ever think when thinking about condiments as adding texture to the food they're eating.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about maybe the white or I guess red elephant in the room who will not be named and why you want to improve on that texture for ketchup and for other condiments?
Yeah, well, I mean, condiments are always, they're never center of plate item. So for us, trying to complement the food has always been goal number one, not overwhelm it. And I think that most ketchup, the red elephant you mentioned, and really all the other ones, it's a sugar bomb. You know,
right.
I think for the most part, ketchup has become something that's sweet, that's designed to be eaten with savory foods. And so it's sort of like mixing dessert with your main meal. And it's something that parents use to get kids to eat something that they don't want to eat. And so for us, we saw an opportunity to make ketchup back into what it was, which was preserving fresh tomatoes. And so every other ketchup has a really sort of plasticine, really gelatinous texture. And we have that sort of rough, a little bit more natural tomato texture. And so for us, that felt closer to what it should be.
So let's go back.
What is ketchup? Where did it come from?
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize ketchup was... When I say let's go back, I want to go back like 100... Like, is ketchup really 100 years old?
Oh, more, longer. Much more than that.
So yes. What's... So
who did it first?
Do you guys want to guess?
I'm going to go with the English just because.
Okay.
I don't want to say Italians because I feel like that they probably see ketchup as a...
Here's a hint. We were just talking about this country.
Is it Americans?
No.
I have to go back and listen.
So ketchup is actually a Chinese word.
Oh.
Yeah.
And oh, we were just...
What?
Oh.
Like,
and
what?
The flavor technology of ketchup, essentially when it comes to a savory... acidic condiment that would accompany things like meats or, you know, rice, tofu, some basic proteins like that and starches. That's a Chinese word, and it was the Dutch and the English seamen who were in Asia in the South China Sea and tasting it. They brought this concept of this savory condiment back to Europe.
Wow.
And it was only
when was that?
This was the
so early, opium and ketchup.
Early 1800s, okay. Really.
Those great ketchup wars of the late 1800s
really
tore the Western world apart.
And at the same and roughly around the same time, Hernan Cortez discovered the tomato in the New World, mm-hmm. because it, you know, the tomato was never native to Europe or to Asia. It was something that was a South American native plant, and so it was brought back to Europe. And so the English were making mushroom ketchups.
What?
They were making it's walnut ketchups. Anything with that high quantity of glutamate, that savory flavor that we know. And it was, and people don't know exactly, but it was either the English or it was the Americans that combined the flavor technology of ketchup as a savory sauce with tomatoes. And ultimately, it was a way to sort of semi-ferment and preserve tomatoes so that they can be consumed all year round because, you know, tomatoes have a short growing and harvesting season, but people absolutely love them.
I could just see that conversation. It's like, Kensington, you're out of your mind. Tomatoes instead of mushrooms in the ketchup? But man, he knew his onto. So now that we know where ketchup comes from, where did you guys get your idea to start making condiments and start? Because the ketchup was the first one for you guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys cook, or did you guys just see an opportunity, or did you, in the way that there was once only Budweiser and Coors, you were like, you know, we're not even going to go after the big guys. We're going to just do something for people who want something a little bit more artisanal.
Well, we went to college together, and
shout it out.
We went to Brown.
Boston, London. Yeah. Providence.
No, Providence, buddy.
Providence.
Yeah. Sorry,
Harvard is the one in Boston.
Sorry,
we didn't get in there.
So okay. You actually went to college in Boston. You should know
this. College in Boston. I was just thinking my time. Anyway, forget it. First day back, a little rusty.
Happy New Year.
So we went to college together. We were friends. We were not professionally involved with food whatsoever. We didn't cook it professionally. We didn't work in restaurants, but we always really loved food. We were always around food, always talking about food. And it was our last 6 months of school. We didn't have any big senior projects, but we were just talking about this idea that, you know, so much in the food world was changing. There were so many, you know, you go to the grocery store, there were so many options from...
What year?
This was 2008.
Okay.
And obviously it's only gotten more, right. More so like this, but 2008, you know, whether you wanted something natural or expensive or cheap or whatever, you had unlimited choice in basically every category, mm-hmm. except ketchup. It was this one thing that had been the same for 50 years. And we said it was like if you went to go buy a car and every car in every dealership looked like a VW Beetle, that's ketchup. Every ketchup is the same in a different label. And so we just started looking
at
recipes.
That's probably why I don't have ketchup.
I love ketchup.
I don't like ketchup. Maybe I'm going to change.
Yeah.
So you guys weren't cooking, but did you guys... So how did you start developing... And you can share as much as you want, but like how did you start developing a new type of ketchup? Did you go with an idea and then work chefs or?
Well, we really, I mean, first of all, just conceptually, you know, what Mark is describing is seeing so many things in food changing to the way that people were starting to eat. You know, there's this concept that food is in between nature and culture. And if you look at what ketchup had become, it was a result of the mid-century sort of military-industrial complex of World War II, something that could last for years and years without, you know, with preservatives and could be shipped across the world and was something that was really engineered to be cheap. And whereas everything else was changing to be closer to the agricultural products that were involved in it and also were catering to a more sophisticated palate. So America famously loves sweet foods. You know, as a country, we love sweet foods.
Right. Coke.
Coca-Cola, you know, like incredibly
sugar,
sweet.
Sugar, just everything.
Sugar bombs.
Yeah. Everything.
Sugar.
Yeah. And, but that, you know, in sort of niche places, that was really starting to change. And so, you know, immediately that was the thing that leapt out to us from a personal taste standpoint, that normal ketchup was just way too sweet. And so when we started, we began by saying, okay, you know, we want to use all natural ingredients. We don't really want to use as much sugar, but we will really focus on the flavor and the taste before everything else. And we also want to have a really distinctive kind of cultural positioning. We want people to know that if, you know, if this is going to end up on the shelf, we're not going to have a big marketing budget or anything like that. So we want people to immediately know this is dramatically different. So we said, okay, if we're going to put this in a package, it's going to be glass if they do plastic, and it's going to be scooping if they do squirting. And if they're Americana, we're going to be English.
Amazing. Mm. And then how long did it take from the, like, figuring out what you wanted to do to actually landing on the exact recipe?
It took about, well, it took the rest of our senior year. So over the course of 4 or 5 months, we developed maybe 8 recipes at the high end.
And then were you working with just yourself?
No, just in our kitchen.
That's awesome.
Scott's kitchen. Yeah, which probably still smells like tomato sauce.
Oof.
Yeah. But
I have a question.
Yeah.
Are there cultures in which ketchup is not prepackaged? Like, you know, like if you go to the Mediterranean, people make their own mayonnaise, like everything like that. Or is there anywhere where people are like, oh, we're going to make ketchup? Or is it always just this thing that's like kind of like this store-bought, long shelf life, you always just kind of have in a cupboard or in the fridge?
It's definitely become an American export in terms of something that's always shipped around and packaged. I mean, at least to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's not something that cultures do. I mean, well, certainly the concept of creating a homemade condiment that has all the 5 basic tastes, which ketchup does, sweet, sour, salty, savory, and bitter. Mm-hmm. You know, you can find those in chutneys. You can find those even in some
chili
mustards.
And
chili paste. But calling it ketchup, that's something that has this iconic understanding of, like, the packaging of the squeeze bottle or the packet. You know, that's something that is really an American export.
Got it.
Awesome. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. I want to hear about how you went from out of the kitchen and into the glass jar and then onto the shelves, and then about the other condiments, and then that awesome, the fry exhibit that you guys did in Lower East Side.
It's okay.
Thank you.
We are here with Scott and Mark of Sir Kensington's. And when we last left you, they were talking about how they perfected their recipe. And so how did you go from starting what essentially was a small business and branding, building brand awareness, getting people excited, and getting people to think that they needed another ketchup in their lives? And you have 15 seconds to answer all that.
Okay. Well, to begin at the beginning, when we had those 8 recipes, we didn't know what was good.
Yeah.
So we had a series of what we called ketchup tasting parties. And, you know, we went to Brown, so they weren't the weirdest parties happening on campus. We got a good amount of people to show up. They, you know, we had wine and we had, you know, German dance music. We had tasting cards and we asked people to tell us which, how to rate each ketchup on, you know, a variety of factors. And that's how we settled on a recipe we thought was good. And ever since then, every new recipe we develop, that's how we get it out. That's how we spread the word from the very early days, is get people involved and make it feel more like a family, make it feel more like a brand that's about entertainment than it is just about nutrition or just about the ingredients.
And we had this sort of intuition that if we were to just make these ketchups and point at it and say, that's the best ketchup, I mean, what do we know? We wanted to hear what people said. We wanted to kind of let people's reactions guide the product, because we knew that we wouldn't get any traction if we were purely just trying to educate based on some platonic ideal. We actually wanted to create something that we knew people said they liked, and that's why we did these blind tastings.
So what was the, let's fast forward a little, but what was the, so you're out there, you got ketchup in glass bottles, it's on shelves. Do you remember what the tipping point was for when it went from, can we do this, to, oh, we are doing this and people are really responding to the product we're putting out there?
First I would say, I don't know if we've hit the tipping point yet. I do think that in, you know, we're based in New York, so here I think a lot of people have seen it and heard of it. You know, when we go across the country to other states that we're starting in, it's still very early days.
Yeah.
I think that when we came out with mayonnaise, that's when people started to actually notice the ketchup, ironically.
Interesting.
You know, I think that we spent 2 years only making ketchup, and people are so not interested in hearing about ketchup for all the reasons we were talking about. And so that continues to be a challenge, but people love fat, they love mayo. Our mayo, I think, is awesome. And so that was sort of a gateway drug for people to find the brand and find the ketchup. And so I think that was a big tipping point for us.
So what are all the condiments? You have mayo, you have ketchup.
And mustard. Oh, there is mustard.
There is.
Yeah.
So you're in the mustard. I mean, you're in the mustard game, which is probably an easier entry access than the ketchup or even the mayo game.
Lower barriers to entry.
Yeah.
But
I think people are used to, like, various types of mustard. People are open to, like, mustard, you know? Like, people are like, French's is not by any means like the mustard.
I don't think there's any dominant mustard, right?
Well, I mean, you know, this country, French's yellow is definitely, if you look at the numbers, the dominator. However,
sure, you still have Grand Poupon, though.
You do, but the structure of the market in with ketchup and mayonnaise, Heinz and Hellmann's really dominate, whereas mustard is much more distributed. And a lot of regional brands, a lot of smaller niche flavors. You'll see purple mustards, you know, local craft brewery mustards, all kinds of stuff like that.
So what are some of the less common uses of vehicles to get that ketchup and mustard and mayo into people's faces? I'm assuming fries and burgers are number one.
Right.
But what, I mean, I'm sure people write you all the time, you're like, I used your ketchup on blank.
Well, we were, you know, over the years, we've heard people use it in like pad Thai recipes, because ketchup is often used as a recipe in different Southeast Asian noodle dishes. And then on the mayonnaise, actually, I mean, everything from, you know, tuna salad to Japanese hand rolled onigiri.
Okay.
They'll make like this like tuna salad onigiri with the mayonnaise. And then we also make flavored condiments as well. So we have a classic ketchup, mustard, and mayo. But we also have a chipotle mayonnaise, a sriracha mayonnaise, and a...
Ooh, sriracha mayonnaise is...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's done.
Thank you. And so those, I think, lend themselves to a lot of other things, you know, like, you know, a sushi roll sauce, something like that. But, you know, we see a lot of omelets, a lot of eggs, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I love ketchup on egg and cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite dipping sauce. So you guys did something really cool last year, at the end of last year, where you celebrated essentially the French fries in New York, which was literally called Fries in New York.
Yeah.
Talk about that exhibit, because it was unlike any other food exhibit I've ever seen, both historically and fun, and a real real in-depth retrospective or just overview of the Fries in New York. And how did you come up with that? And talk to us about what the whole exhibition was.
Yeah. Well, you know, in these 4 years, as we've been making ketchup and working with restaurants, we have seen and sampled so many French fries.
How many fries?
Well, there were about 100 fries in the show. Wow. But we've definitely had more varieties than that.
Yeah, I mean, countless.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands.
Don't you hate when you get a really bad soggy fry?
It's the worst.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like no one ever says, make them extra soggy.
Yeah.
What that cool.
Actually, it's funny. We heard things like that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. People would come into the exhibition. They'd be like, I actually like my fries soggy. And we'd be like,
disgusting.
Well, hey, you know, there's no accounting for taste.
I guess when you're doing something that super indulgent, like the French fry is probably one of the most indulgent foods, and it scratches that comfort itch. Like,
right.
You want it exactly as...
Yeah,
it's funny. We've been selling to restaurants since we started, and every time we would go to a restaurant, we would have their burger
to have
the ketchup. And so we quickly got tired of burgers, but never got tired of French fries.
Never tired of fries.
Fries are amazing. They're kind of like the perfect food. Yeah. Who has the best fries?
Oh.
Do you want to say that on air?
You might get beat up. Who's my favorite child? I don't know if we can name that. I had some really, really good fries today. It's not one of the ones that was featured in the exhibit, but there's a restaurant called Birdsall House up in Peekskill, and they have a restaurant in the East Village.
Okay,
they're really good.
But to give the listeners kind of a visual and more about the exhibit, you know, we're fascinated by food and food culture, and that's really how we communicate as a brand, is around food education and food entertainment. And we realized that everyone had looked at burgers, and there were ranking lists and burger maps of New York and of the country. There were documentaries about it, but the French fry had been overlooked. And actually, the French fry, when you really look up close at it, there's so many different varieties.
Amazing.
So we cataloged 12 different varieties of French fries. For example, waffle cut, curly cut, straight cut, skinny fries, sweet potato fries. Even palm souffle and really different interesting culinary techniques to create fries. And we took one of each fry from 100 different restaurants, and we preserved them behind a glass display case in an exhibition open to the public. And it was, as you say, in the Lower East Side, bordering Soho. And it was open for 3 days. And we had just about 3,000 people come.
Amazing.
And it was open to the public for free. And it was, I mean, it was really a highlight of my life because, I mean, people came in from Newark, New Jersey. One guy brought a potato. And he says, you know, my potato's name is Russ, as in Russ at Burbank. And he said, you know, you should have a sign that says that this exhibition might be... you know, might cause fear in potatoes. Russ was scared straight. And, you know, it was moments like that where we realized that we had created something that was a little bit bigger than ourselves, and that felt really good.
It was great. And did you serve up French fries and ketchup while people were there?
We did a couple times, yeah.
So Friday was like the main day. Yeah. We had a Friday
Love
happy
it.
Hour. Yeah.
Not lost on me. Love that pun. Good. And you serve fries and ketchup.
And we serve fries there, and they quickly ran out. I mean, people
love fries.
People love fries.
Like, nobody is ever going to pass on a fry.
It was, you know, to be fair to the guests who came outside of those windows, it must have been really hard because they were walking around looking at fries and salivating over fries.
But they actually went and got fries after.
I would be surprised if no one went and got fries.
I think they did. Yeah.
So what are the next steps? What do you guys got coming up? World dominance?
Not quite. Definitely not quite. I mean, you know, there's so much left to do that's really within the reach of what we're already doing. I mean, there's so many great retailers that we don't work with yet. There's so many fantastic chefs and so many great burgers in this country. You know, we're very far from world domination. And frankly, you know, world domination is not a great game. So we're looking right now on a couple new products, new sizes of our products, and developing some new flavors as well. Mm-hmm. And those are going to hit late spring of this year, which we're really excited about.
Awesome. So where can people find you online?
So our website is sirkensingtons.com, and you can find it nationwide in retail and Whole Foods.
You guys got Instagram, Twitter?
Yep.
It's all at Sir Kensington.
How's the Instagram game for the ketchup, the condiments?
I'm going to follow right now.
Well, you know, we food is such a visual thing.
Yeah.
And Instagram has been really transformational, not only to sort of put out there what we're doing, but also working with so many restaurants and so many people that actually cook at home. It's incredible to see the meals that people come up with and the inspiration and the praise. And, you know, for instance, we just did this partnership with Mimi Chang's, which is a dumpling shop in East Village.
Yep.
And they did a special January brunch dumpling, and it was served with our ketchup. And it was just incredible to see all these people come there and experience the food through their phones. You know, it's like some, it's like this mark in their diary, and you know, and taking pictures of the ketchup and the dumplings together, and people kind of create this media all around their lives.
Well, and honestly, the Fries of New York, it was set up to be very photo worthy.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, that's how, as Scott said, that's how people live their life, is oftentimes through a phone.
Yeah. There's actually a really great article on that on coolhunting.com if people want to go check it out. Well, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Love the ketchup.
Thank you.
Love the
thank
mayo.
You.
Love the mustard. I'm excited to just eat more of it. I like mixing the mayo and the ketchup together and dipping my fries in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they call it golf spring, sauce. Come this spring, you might not need to do it manually.
Oh.
Wow.
Is that a Snacky Tunes exclusive?
That you heard it here first.
Boom.
Yeah.
See that, Liz? See that? Yeah, I'm getting thumbs up from the engineer. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to have Klaus on live. This is a quick little song.
Someday, when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Oh, but you're lovely, with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft. There is nothing for me but to love you and the way you look tonight. With each word, your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart, and the that wrinkles your nose touches my foolish heart. You are lovely, never ever change. Keep that breathless charm, won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you and the way tonight, and the way you look tonight.
We are here with Brooklyn's very own Klaus. Welcome Chris and Lewis to Snacky Tunes.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good, good. I'm loving this. I'm saying I got two dudes and double the amount of synthesizers. So welcome. So for those who don't know Klaus.
So Klaus is Chris and Lewis. We've been playing together in various iterations over the past 10 years or so. And this is our most recent project. It's the first time the both of us have played as a duo. And yeah, you know, that's it.
I love the idea that you guys are, and I'm quoting here because there's no way I could come up with this, WBLS funk and industrial dance music, and you guys are right in the middle.
That's the goal.
That is the goal. How did you guys draw those two very different polar opposite ends of the music spectrum as influences?
Well, I can tell you that a big part of it is the hardware that's used in both types of those music. They share similar hardware, similar synthesizers, similar production techniques. And though you maybe wouldn't realize it at first, a lot of the music that was made by in both of those genres, the 80s funk and sort of early industrial dance music, it does have a similar sonic quality. It's just the message is entirely different. And so we're basically trying to draw that bridge and make it a little more obvious for the listener how these two music forms are related.
Yeah, it's like you might recognize the sounds from the synthesizer, be like, oh, that sounds like an 80s funk sound, and oh, wait, that sounds like an industrial sound. And so we're kind of combining both of those genres to come up with what we think sounds good.
Awesome. All right, well, enough, I'm sure people are scratching their heads who did not catch the very opening track of the song, but can we hear one live?
Absolutely.
Okay, here we go. What are you guys going to be playing?
Funky Fantasy.
Funky Fantasy. All right, we got Brooklyn's very own Klaus, Funky Fantasy, here live on Snacky Tunes.
T-minus 10, 9, das 8, 7, das 6, Klaus. 5, Klaus. 4, Klaus. 3, 2, Klaus. 1...
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I totally get it. Like, I totally see it. It's so much fun. Oh, my God. And that laugh with the effects. Oh, my God. No, no, no. You can leave it. You can leave it. I just don't even... Don't change the magic. So, pretty epic. Pretty awesome. A lot of fun. When you guys are writing together, are you... I imagine that you guys are thinking about both the tracks and then playing it live and things like that. So, what's the process? Like, how do you guys start on something like that and then wind up with what we just heard?
All right. Well, I mean, it changes song by song. I mean, we've been getting together and playing and just trying out ideas with the hardware, with the hard synths, and then creating the songs from there, so that making sure that we can play it live.
Yeah.
But we also use the computer often because it's sometimes easier to kind of compose and arrange things in the computer and then trying to find ways to play that with our hardware live. So it sort of depends on the song, how it comes about.
And then, so when you guys are writing within the computer versus the hardware, do you guys split it, or do you guys like pull? Where do you pull your inspiration from?
I would say a lot of it is from film.
Yeah,
we spend a good amount of time watching movies, particularly 70s and 80s movies. Although a lot of current movies, mostly horror and sci-fi, and we sort of take sonic influences and thematic influences from that, and then try to inject it into that idea that we were talking about earlier, the mix of the 80s R&B and the sort of industrial dance music.
Favorite sci-fi, favorite horror movie?
That's tough.
Pick one. And look, it's like saying what's your best French fry, but just...
Come on.
Come on.
Like,
one?
Seriously, people?
I don't know. Lewis, what do you think?
I don't know about a favorite, but we could maybe just say our most recent one we watched was this movie Gunhead. It's like this Japanese movie that started, I believe, as a comic book, or I'm not sure if it started as a comic book, but it's a good example we're talking about where it's kind of this, it's a sci-fi movie and the sounds that you hear in the soundtrack, similar, it's like a lot of the similar hardware, like we were saying, it's just another place where we hear these sounds and go, oh, that, you know, like that phrase or that melody or that sound in this scene, this weird glowing green pool and these guys in suits coming in, like this sounds like something that Klaus could score. This is like... We'd like to be there playing that.
I could see you guys like watching movies together, like in the studio, just like hitting the pause button, just riffing right on the synthesizers.
It's kind of like that. Although we'll sometimes hear the very synthesizers that we own in the soundtracks. For instance, Star Trek: The Next Generation. This keyboard, the Roland D50.
Yeah.
If you watch The Next Generation, you have heard this like hundreds of times.
So dropping a little Picard, a little Worf.
A little Picard, a little Worf. We make it so.
Make it so. Oh, my God. All right. On that, let's hear another tune.
All right.
What are we going to hear?
This one's called Deliverance.
Awesome. All right. Here we go. Klaus. Dude, I am loving literally the serious nature of having this like musical background during this interview. Liz, what do you think? Should we have all of our interviews backed by music? I'm getting two thumbs up.
It's definitely the way to go.
Definitely the way to go.
We'll come score your interviews.
Oh, my God. House band class.
All right.
All right, here we go. Live on Snacky Tunes. Ooh. Super nice.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I love that. God, I love that reverb on standard interview questions. So I want to go back to talk about your live shows, because you guys had the honor of playing some of the Last Land shows, which was arguably the final death of the local music venue scene, if you will.
Yes. That's not true.
I know. That's not... I mean, for that...
Arguably, if you think that the world is Williamsburg.
Arguably?
I don't know.
Is there a counterpoint? No. Yeah. I mean from more that specific area, and I think it was just because the confluence of events where the rapid shutting of a year of all the events. But you guys got to play there and sort of like be... We were there in that last month, and how did those shows come together? What was it like playing in such like a famous venue, if you will?
It was a fantastic experience. We were able to play twice in December.
Amazing.
The first show was at the Glasslands staff party, a.k.a. Stafflands. The second show, which was...
They did not waste a single opportunity for us.
No, they didn't.
No, they were into it. And that was a great party, too.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then the I think it was the penultimate night, anti-penultimate night.
Oh, did you play with cymbals and guitars?
No. That was the 30th, the penultimate, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The penultimate.
The penultimate, yeah. So then we played, and we opened for Trust, and that was a lot of fun, and... We played to about 200 people, maybe, which was probably the biggest crowd that we've played to so far. And nice. they were great experiences. The shows came about, or at least our involvement in them, in part because I had been working at Glasslands for about 4 years as an audio engineer there.
Great work, man.
Thank you.
That venue, I was there at the earlier shows, and one of the things that really impressed me was how you guys finally at Glasslands, like... made it into a real sounding venue.
It took a while.
It took a while, but and the different setups, moving the speakers and things like that was really amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. It's something that we definitely put a lot of work into, and I was really happy to be a part of a venue, period, when I joined Glasslands, when people would say the sound sucked, and then I was so happy to be a part of a venue where people were saying that the sound actually sounds good. And so that kind of Glasslands and their growth sort of coincided with my growth as an audio engineer as well.
I love that place. That was the most, like, if you were in a movie, it's like smash cut Williamsburg.
Totally.
Music. Scene.
Totally.
It was like interior Glasslands.
Absolutely.
And that must have been so awesome. And then you guys are doing another series of shows recently, right, with Popgun?
That was the Popgun shows.
That was the Popgun show. But was it just those two, or were you doing more of them?
It was just those two.
We played at Mercury Lounge a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
and then we played at Mercury Lounge.
We had kind of three shows in, three, 4 weeks. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and so hopefully we'll do some more work with them. Some of the Popgun guys are friends. So
shout out to those guys.
Rami, those guys. Jake, Rami. Gnome. Great folks.
Great folks.
Yeah.
And the Bearhead is in Greg, the other guy, Snaggy Tunes.
Yeah.
In his apartment right now.
Oh, really?
He's the one who bought it and then lent it back.
Oh, I see. Oh, I didn't know that.
I want to know who got the weird fur...
I think that thing had some. I think it was diseased. If it were an animal, it would have probably been put down.
I wouldn't be surprised
if it's in a dumpster somewhere.
It's time to go. Well, I want to make sure we have enough time for one song, but I really love talking to you guys.
Likewise, man. Thank you for having us on. Thank you very much.
Of course. So, where can people find you guys? What do you got coming up? Where can people get your music? I know you have a SoundCloud.
We do. Yeah. It's SoundCloud is underscore Klaus underscore, so that's not very easy to remember. So I just direct anyone who's interested in the music to go to facebook.com/KlausTheBand.
Klaus with a K or with a C?
Klaus with a K. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, Klaus with a K. And Klaus the Band. Most of our stuff is Klaus the Band.
How's your Instagram game? A lot of French fries and ketchup?
Yeah,
oh, I'm sorry. It's the wrong guess. God.
A lot of synthesizers.
So rough today.
It's like synth porn, really.
You know, the great thing about synthesizers is that they're really photographable, and people just...
that's next time. We can talk about that.
That's next time. I actually believe that bands should never put up photos of them playing live or anything to do with their music.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I like the.
You mean on Instagram or you mean
Instagram.
In general?
Like on Instagram. It's like, I want to see... like. I don't need to see a photo of you guys playing. Like, I want to see, like, you guys out in the world, like, having fun, like, eating tacos and things like that.
Cool.
We'll keep that in mind as we step up our Instagram game.
Yeah, we need a Klaus Instagram.
We don't actually have one. We have individual Instagrams, but they're mostly selfies and Lewis
pictures
and I.
of synths.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess you know, the Beth Synth Instagram account could be a thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. There are quite a few, trust me.
I'm sure there are. And so when's the next show? When can people see you live?
We don't currently have a show scheduled at the moment.
All right, so bookers of New York, fucking up. Reach out to us if you want to book them.
Next Sunday on Snaggytunes.
Yeah, next Sunday.
Hopefully.
It's the house band.
That'd be great.
Scoring the interviews with a doomy synthesized wall.
Yeah, just a low hum, be like, I didn't know I was this nervous about talking about pizza, but okay. Okay.
So right now we're working on recording, and I think we're going to make a video for the next song that we're going to play.
Definitely make a video, yeah. It was really easy to share our music when we made a video, was it last year?
Yeah,
for Chump, the song they played earlier today. It's a great way to just like send stuff to people.
It's fun.
Where
did you guys shoot that?
That's a good question. We shot it in a few places.
Okay.
But primarily, I live in Greenpoint.
Yeah.
And when I'm fortunate enough that I live somewhere that has a view, and I can see Manhattan, which is lovely, Long Island City, which is all right. But then I can see this nuclear waste facility. It's like a waste treatment plant, basically. And it's fucking... Oh, sorry. Can
I say it?
Okay. You can.
You can.
It's fucking amazing. It's beautiful. I mean, it's a testament to, man and engineering. And it's just, looks like it's from another planet.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So we did most of it there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so what's the last song you're going to play?
So this is called Rise.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys. Cool. You guys can get up. And Carter.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Carter, thank you so much.
Sorry I wasn't on the slopes of Park City or anything. You know, I had to come in.
No, it's fine. I want to say a special shout out to Sarah Hooper. Happy birthday.
Oh, yeah. Big Bear also on the slopes.
Big Bear also on the slopes. The whole West Coast crew out there.
We're about
there.
To get the biggest snowstorm in the history of New York, apparently.
Yeah. So be safe. There. Hunker down. Get some pizza now.
Catch up, too.
Shout out to Mom and Dad, and shout out to Lindsay Buckingham for impregnating me on Thursday night at the Garden.
It's disgusting.
I'm so afraid. That solo just put a baby right in my stomach.
Disgusting.
All right, guys. Sir Kensington, thank you so much. Go buy it. Damn the red man. That's where it worked. Not that much. I promise.
I don't know if you can say that.
Maybe not.
Yeah, that's not what you should say.
I shouldn't say that. Thank you guys so much. We'll be back next week. We're going to be here all month. Super excited. Shout out to Roberta's Heritage. Liz, always. Thank you so much. I hope you've been writing down all these awesome ideas of house bands and things like that. You guys ready? All right. Here we go. Klaus, one last time, live on Snacky Tunes, and we'll see you next week.
Cosa fanno gli strepiti?
Il male.
Suzanne, Kim, Linda, Jessica, and I'm Janie.
Conoscono e praticano segreti occulti che danno loro il potere di agire sulla realtà, sulle persone. Ma solo, ripeto, solo, in senso maligno. Capisce, cara?
Suzanne, Kim, Linda, Jessica, and
il loro scopo è ottenere vantaggi materiali e personali, ma possono raggiungerli esclusivamente con il male degli altri, con la malattia, con la sofferenza, il dolore... E non di rado con la morte di coloro che prendono di mira per una qualsiasi ragione.
Hey, Lieutenant, wasn't this the old Hodgstetter place? We'll be right back.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.